To talk today about a period before he became Gaon. Remember we said he's originally from Egypt. He spends time in Israel, if I remember correctly, before he goes to Bavel, where he ultimately becomes the Gaon in Sura. We talked last time about his Ha'egron, his dictionary that he composed. We saw samples of it. And then we started talking about the history of what I termed Isla Jews, hybrids of Islam and Judaism. And we were going to wrap that up before we get to where all this leads, which is this calendar controversy that is such a bizarre story. So we talked about the sects that formed, hybridizing Judaism and Islam under the heavy and aggressive influence of Islam. There were also false messiahs at this point. Fascinating. I brought you one source on this from 200 years after of Sajid Gaon, just because it's a good illustration, from the Rambam's letter to the Jews of Yemen, Igeret Teiman. Take a look at what he says to them in this piece of the letter. He says, V'yesh alechem ladas. He says, you should know. Ki betchilas malchus Yishmael, in the beginning of the Arab Empire, as I translated it, right, the reign of Yishmael, Amar ish be'ever hanahar va'amar shehu mashiach. There was this guy who was on the bank of the river, and I don't know which river he means when he says that. He does not mean the Jordan River. That we know.
Maybe the Tigris or the Euphrates and everything in that area.
So the problem is not for the Rambam. Rambam lives in Egypt, and Yemen isn't anywhere near those. So maybe. In any case, right. He declared himself Mashiach. V'yatza bichlal aseres alafim mi Yisrael. He had about 10,000 Jews with him. V'haya ha'os shelo. Shalom mitzorah v'ishkin bari. How do I know that I'm Mashiach? Because I went to bed with a skin problem. He was a mitzorah, he had tzaras, and he got up and it was gone. V'lo nishlam isko v'lo amda atzaso. But it didn't actually pan out. Uchmochein, another example. Amad ish echad b'mara b'medinas Fez. Hayom arboyim ushmona shana. There was a guy 48 years ago in the land of Fez, in Morocco. Va'amar shehumevaser ushlucho shel Mashiach, and he said he was the herald of Mashiach. Va'amar shebaosa shana yigale, he said that he's going to be revealed that year. V'lo yatsa dvaro la'or, and it didn't happen. V'ischadshu liyisua beglalo tsaros, and he caused all sorts of problems for the Jews. V'hodiyeni adavar azem misha haya matzui bakol, and I heard that from somebody who was there throughout. V'kodem zek kmo eser shan, about 10 years before that. Amad ba'artza sfarad bebedinas Cordova, right? Cordova. Ish echad va'amar shehu Mashiach. There was a guy about 10 years before that in Spain, in the area of Cordoba, who said he was Mashiach. V'kimat kat haisa klaya alson eim shal yisrael bigalalo. And we were almost destroyed because of it, right? He uses the euphemism. He says the enemies of Israel were almost destroyed as a result of this. V'kodem zek moshloshim shana, 30 years before that, Amar echad betzarfat va'amar shehu Mashiach. There was some guy in France who said he was Mashiach. Va'asa osos lafis va'rasam. And he performed what they considered to be signs, miracles. V'haraguhu hatzarfatim, and the French killed him. V'haragu imo klal mikihilos hakodesh. And they killed Jews. So in other words, the Rambam is saying there's a trend of people claiming that they are Mashiach. This is all part of the ferment you have going on. Because look, the Muslims are arising following this fellow who talked to God and is a prophet. And so, you know, it starts people thinking. It gets people going. I wonder a little bit if any of it was tied into 1,000 years from the fall of Bar Kokhba, right? Bar Kokhba is 135, right. So maybe 1,000 years from that, maybe an earlier trend, 1,000 years from the Beis HaMikdash, because people treat millennium as something significant automatically. You saw it, right? You 20 years ago, 25 years ago, you had all sorts of bizarre groups claiming that the end of the world was coming and cults and whatever. So this causes a lot of ferment, and it's important to know about. Yeah, Zev.
And what he's speaking here, only one incident is at the time of the Gaon,
correct,
the beginning of the Arab Empire. He's speaking of more current to his time.
Right. Well, except the first one. Right. That's Malchus Yishmael.
Is the understanding that this is the beginning of those first false messiahs, or did it also start?
So I don't think so. I think this is a trend that's been going. He's giving them cases that may have been well known, cases that are more recent, except for that first one. But no, it seems like this is not new in the Rambam's day. And we know of some that are earlier. There was a fellow in Crete hundreds of years earlier. This wasn't new in their day. Yeah.
And this, did it not continue into the time of the Ramchal?
Well, so Ramchal...
had some huge machlokas about...
So that's from a new wave. That's the Shabtai Tzvi wave.
Right.
Right, that's 1666, which that's Shabtai Tzvi. So, right. And that's triggers a whole new, correct, a whole new wave of it. There were various triggers at different times, got people, you know, thinking that this was it.
Comes in waves then.
Right. In addition, there's another source of conflict, and that is the Gaonate in Eretz Yisrael. Remember, we've said that the Gaonim are supposed to be the heads of the yeshivos in Bavel. However, you had yeshivos in Eretz Yisrael at various times in Tiberia, Yerushalayim, Sor, Damascus, right? They were very influential in North Africa. So we talked already about Jews of Tunisia writing away to Israel for advice, and then the Gaonim being suspicious of the advice that they're getting from Eretz Yisrael. They were influential in Italy. They were usually overshadowed, though, by the Gaonim in Bavel. That was the general trend. But it's important to know about them also for the story that's coming up. The last group we have to talk about before we get into the calendar controversy are the Karaites. We talked about them briefly before, but now we'll talk about them a little bit more because they're very influential in the days of Rav Sajigon and in his activity. So where did the Karaites come from? Well, in the Karaites' perspective, from their point of view, they were an outgrowth of the Tzedukim, of the Sadducees, who are around in the second Beis HaMikdash, who are very popular, as a matter of fact, at one point in the Beis HaMikdash. They're wealthy, they're the aristocracy, they're Kohanim. And the way the Karaites tell it was that these murderous rabbis tried to get rid of the Tzedukim, but their path continued over the centuries as a sect, and that's who we are today. We, the Karaites, are the outgrowth of the Sadducees. That was their perspective. It will be obvious that the rabbis did not share that view of where the Karaites were coming from. And I'll show you two different views that were presented in rabbinic literature. One in the Kuzari, Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi, you see, 11th century Spain. We'll have to talk about him for sure. But look at his statement of who they are. It actually, you know, you sort of wonder whether he couldn't be claiming that they're descendants of the Sadducees. I don't know. Take a look. He says, this is the Hirschfeld translation. I took that one just because it was one I could cut and paste, you know, online, not because it's any particularly better than any other translation. The next generation was that of the high priest, Shimon HaTzadik, Simon the Just, and his disciples and friends. He was followed by Antignos of Socho of great fame, right? Mishnah Pirkei Avos, Altiyu Kavadim. His disciples were Tzadok and Baitos, who were the originators of the sects called after them Sadduceans and Bothusians. After him came, and various generations, after him came Yehuda ibn Tabai and Shimon ben Shetach with the friends of both. At this period arose the doctrine of the Karaites, in consequence of an incident between the sages and King Yanai, who was a priest. His mother was under the suspicion of being a profane woman. One of the sages alluded to this, saying to him, "Be satisfied, King Yanai, with the royal crown, but leave the priestly crown to the seed of Aaron. You should not be claiming to be a Kohen. You're of inappropriate lineage." He's not a proper Kohen. Chalal, perhaps. So his friends, Yanai's friends, prejudiced him against the sages, advising him to browbeat, expel, and scatter or kill them. And we have stories in the Gemara about Yanai HaMelech and his fights with Shimon ben Shetach and with the rabbi. Shimon ben Shetach survives. Sorry? So you're talking second Beis HaMikdash. And he replied, "If I destroy the sages, what will become of our law?" "There is the written law," they replied. "Whoever wishes to study it may come and do so. Take no heed of the oral law." He followed their advice and expelled the sages, and among them Shimon ben Shetach, his son-in-law. Rabbinism was laid low for some time. The other party tried to establish a law built on their own conception, but failed until Shimon ben Shetach returned with his disciples from Alexandria and restored tradition to its former condition. So in the Kuzari's telling of it, this is a group that's later than that original Tzduki group. They counseled Yanai HaMelech to get rid of the Chachamim, and they were going to work with the written Torah and their own tradition that they were going to create. Shem ben Shaddach comes back, though, ultimately to defeat them. The Karaites turn their attention to the fundamental principles, the methods of analyzing the written text of the Torah to learn Torah Shebe'al Peh, deducing the special laws from them by means of arguments, the damage often extended to the roots through their ignorance rather than intention. They were ignorant people. So, in his view, it's a sect that begins at the time of Yanai HaMelech and Shimon ben Shetach. That's what we're talking about. Late second Beis HaMikdash. The Tzukim is still in existence. So I think so, because the Tzukim are involved, remember, at the time of the destruction of the second Beis HaMikdash.
Okay.
Right,
so
by Rome. They're both around. You have these different sects that are operating. Sadducees or Karaites?
Karaites
exist. There are pockets of Karaites to this day. Yes.
Whoa.
Yep. Some are in Israel, I believe. I believe I'm told that there are some outside of Muncie, interestingly. That's what I haven't researched it, but that's what I've been told. And I've been told there are some in Chicago.
Chicago.
Look them up online. Google them. Find the Karaite.org. Karaites.org. I don't know.
Karaites.
And then you have the Rivet. Now, be careful when you talk about the Ravid, because there are three Ravids. The big famous one in Yeshiva, the one who wrote his commentaries on the Mishneh Torah, that is the third Ravid. That's the third Rabbi Avraham ben David or Abraham ibn Daud. This is the first Ravid we're talking about. And he wrote a book called Seder HaKabbalah, which gives, not Kabbalah like mysticism, history, tradition. So there's the first one, that's Ravid 1, then there's the second one who wrote, I think, Sefer HaEshkol, and then the third one who writes on the Rambam. So look at what he has to say. This is Rabbi Avram ibn Daud the first in 12th century Spain. He says, Ubi Amav Haya Anan Vishaul Bino Shem Rishoyim Yerkav. In those days there was this fellow Anan and his son Shaul, may the name of the wicked rot. The Anan is Zemi based Sur Haya. He's from the house of Tzur. V'tamal chacham haya b'tchila. He was a tamal chacham at first. V'hikiru bo shemetz psul. But they identified in him something wrong. There was something off about him in terms of his righteousness. V'bnechein lo nismach legon. And therefore, they didn't give him the position of gon. They didn't let him be a leader. V'gam lo si'uhu min hashamayim lios reish galus. And Hashem did not assist him in becoming the reish galusa, the exilarch either. So he was shut out of both positions. And this soiling, filth, whatever, that was in his heart, helsa sirton. It raised up sirton. Sirton is the term for a delta. You know, when a river runs down to the end and it carries silt down, right? That's sirton. It caused this sirton to accumulate. V'amad lahasis es Yisrael me'al kabbalas chachamim mipi hanaviim edim ksherim pi'edim ksherim k'moshe sidarnu sefer zeh. And he says the result of this was that he tried to dissuade the Jews from following the tradition that had been passed down from the Nevi'im, from proper witnesses to that tradition, as we've organized here. Benas says, Zakin Mamre al pi based in Labilti, Shemo Elashoftim, and he became a rebellious elder. Right? He's rebelling against the words of the Beis Din, not listening to the Rabbanim, the Vechiber, Sfarim, Veham, Betalmidim, Ubada Milibo, Chukim, Lotovim. And he composed books, he set up his school of students, and he invented laws, bad laws, Chukim Lo Tovim, borrowing a phrase from Navi, because the truth is that the heretics have become weaker after the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash, and Anan at some point strengthened them. He is presenting this as though it's during the period of the Gaonim. Right? I mean, he's talking about not being not being Reish Galusa.
Right.
This fellow, Anan ben David, we know, is an 8th century figure. He's in Baghdad, and that's who he is talking about here. So the Karaites become known for their belief in a very limited type of rabbinic authority and oral tradition. So there was heresy around, and he gave them purpose. He gave them a doctrine. Yeah.
Specifically, Karaites.
Correct. So examples of their beliefs This is a well-known one. No Shabbos candles, because the Torah says, Lo sebaru esh b'chol moshe v'seichem. You're not supposed to burn fire in your dwellings all through Shabbos. So we understand that to mean you're not supposed to light a fire. But once lit, it's already lit. However, they said, no, you're not supposed to have a fire burning in your home on Shabbos. I've seen it argued that that's the source for the bracha on Shabbos candles, that it was a counter to the Karaites, because Shabbos candles, we talked about this in the shiur on LED lights and Shabbos candles, we said that the origin of Shabbos candles is one of three things or some combination of them. It's honor for Shabbos, create a nice atmosphere. It's oneg Shabbos, it gives you pleasure, you eat by light and it's enjoyable. Or, you know, shalom bayis, peace in the home, you're not tripping over things, people can get along, and it's nicely prepared, and all of those things kind of interact. But we have plenty of things that we do for all of those purposes that don't get a bracha. Right? I mean, we prepare nice food for Shabbos, we do our laundry, we make our beds. There's no bracha on any of that. So it's an interesting suggestion that the reason why there's a bracha on Shabbos candles was a way to make a statement against the Karaites. It's an interesting idea. They don't have Hanukkah. They don't have Purim, because those are rabbi-generated holidays. They probably don't do Yom HaTzmaut either. They set their calendar by lunar observation. None of this business of shifting some of the days and having a fixed calendar. They didn't buy into any of that. Shavuos for them is always a Sunday, because the Torah says, Mimacharas HaShabbos, which we understand to be the day after the Yom Tov, the day after the beginning of Pesach, but they said no, the day after Saturday. So therefore, you count the Omer starting from Sunday, and it's 7 weeks, and therefore Shavuos is also going to be a Sunday.
Do they also portion of the week?
You know, I don't know. I would doubt it would be the same as ours, because the, I would doubt it's the same as ours. Well, by the 8th century, you definitely had an annual cycle. The triennial cycle is gone much earlier than that, so they are doing an annual cycle. But I don't know. Yeah.
So they, I never realized that. I thought they just count Omer straight and then wait till Sunday. How is it that then they are, have they reconciled counting the Omer not on the starting on the second day of...
So, because the Torah doesn't say you have to. According to them, it's we were the ones who did that. Their argument is it's the day after Shabbos. It's the first Sunday.
Well, they're just, they look at the Torah and they say the Karban Omer is the second day.
Correct.
That's that. The counting.
Yeah. The no, I'm sorry. They said the Omer was also brought. They said the Karban Omer was brought on Sunday also. The Omer wasn't brought on the second day of Pesach to them. Because the pasuk says, "Misvartem lachem imacharas haShabbos miyom haviachem es Omer hatinuva." The day after Shabbos, the day when you bring the Karban Omer.
Oh, it's not Shavuos so much. The origin of their belief is within when the Omer starts.
Yeah. Sorry.
That's the origin of it. Then it obviously leads to Shavuos being.
Yeah. Yeah. Let's go back to the Pesukim and Emor, make sure that's correct, but I believe so. Yeah. So, they don't have that. They lack what we consider kind of basic oral traditions, like the idea of bittul b'shishim, right? The idea that if you have milk that gets mixed into meat, but it's less than 1/60th, then it's not considered significant. Like, that's not a thing for them. They do have, by the way, they do have a website, karaites.org. I had missed that in my notes. That's where I found some of their practices.
I mean, any and all gazeres. Not followed.
Yeah.
Right.
None of the Yigal Mitzvah. Yeah, no. They have their own traditions that they've, you know, invented. But
right, so there's hundreds of things they don't do without.
Yeah.
What's the objection to oral history?
So their argument is the rabbis made it up.
That's the,
sorry?
They make
yeah. Oh, yeah.
Hillel made up the whole Torah Shabbat.
Historians identify, well, no, they blame Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai for things. Historians identify an Islamic influence on the Karaites, so that their methods of interpreting verses, some of them are Muslim style for the way they interpret the Quran. They believe in this limited human role in interpreting law. That's a Muslim thing also. And there are certain Jewish practices that had Muslim parallels, and the Karaites emphasized them: washing before davening, bowing during prayer. These are things that the Muslims do also, and the Karaites emphasize them. So all of this sets up the discussion of the calendar controversy in the years 921, 922, and so on. We need history, though. The history of setting the calendar. The calendar was classically fixed by observation of the moon. And there was a group of sages who were in charge. There was something called the Sod HaIbor, the secret of when to add to the calendar. You know, some months are 29, 30, some years you add a month. I think Sod HaIbor is about the latter issue. Gradually, we brought in rules of astronomy, primarily to corroborate or refute the testimony, right? If you think in the Mishnah's time, Rabbi Gamliel had those tablets, and he would investigate with the witnesses and say, well, did you see something looking like this, or did you see something looking like that, in order to determine whether they were telling the truth. The right to set the calendar was in Eretz Yisrael. That the Gemara says. The Mishnah says. It's supposed to be in Israel. However, starting in the beginning of the 4th century, Israel is in decline. And Bavel, which has better conditions, they're living under the Persians, which was much better than living under the Romans, they take their place as the superior source of Torah, and they start being the ones to set the calendar. Just like in the days of Rabbi Akiva, when Rabbi Akiva was outside of Eretz Yisrael, Rabbi Akiva was still the one to fix the calendar, because they said, we don't have anybody greater than him in Israel. So Rabbi Akiva was the one to do it at a point when he was not in Israel. The calendar ends up migrating to Bavel in their day, and that continues to the period of the Gaonim. They continue to set the calendar based on the new moon and observation as late as the 5th century, in the end of the Amoraim. And after that, they start using the fixed calendar. I had a shiur I gave in Allentown where I went through like a lot of stuff on this about how we know when they fix the calendar and different elements. It's not a clear, clean thing. Like Hillel II is setting the calendar and then it looks exactly the way it looks in the luach you receive from Ezra's Torah in the mail. That's not so. We know that because there are documents in the Cairo Geniza with dates on them, and those dates, a particular date, a particular day of the week, don't work within the calendar as we have it established. So certain things were done later. For example, the system of saying that the leap years, right, we have a leap year this year, that there are 7 every 19 years, and it is year 3 out of the cycle, year 6 out of the cycle, year 8 out of the cycle, 11, 14, 17, 19, that pattern was only fixed, I believe, 8th century, maybe 9th century. I think it's 8th century, is when that pattern is fixed. Until then, they sit down and evaluate. Do we need to or do we not need to? Where is the tekufa? Where, you know, they do it that
within
way.
Within Hillel's calendar.
Yes, correct.
And
I'm not.
Said, yeah. Right, and also that within Bavel, they're still taking witnesses, setting it by observation?
So I don't think so. I think Hillel, at that point, I mean, I think that's when observation stops. But not all of the elements of the fixed calendar are about observation. You know, some of the rules that we have are still in flux.
There's still fixing, but there is fixing, but not based on observation.
That's not correct. Observation. Correct.
Because Hillel's around 350 or something.
Somewhere. I don't remember.
I think it ties in with the amount of days in the Hebrew year. 354. There's an argument over it. But there's
okay, that I don't know.
354.
I don't know. Years and years ago, I gave that shiur, I don't know, 20 years ago or something. But it was a fascinating bit of learning. So in the 10th century, you get this fellow, Aharon ben Meir. Aharon ben Meir is born in Israel, learns in Israel, and claims the title of Gaon in the yeshiva in Israel. Claims to be a descendant of the Nisim, who were the leaders of the Jews in Israel, the house of Hillel. Particularly, he identifies Rabbi Gamliel as one of his ancestors, Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi, Rebbe, as one of his ancestors. And he's a serious Talmud Chacham. This is not a rabble-rouser. Well, he might be, but he's a serious Talmud Chacham. He's also a very good writer. And he's very, very strong-willed. And he takes on the calendar. In the summer of 921 on the secular calendar, 4681 in the Jewish calendar, word comes to Rav Sadia, who is not yet a Gaon, that this fellow, Aharon ben Meir, intends to change the calendar. He says, they're doing it wrong in Bavel. And Rav Sadia sends letters to ben Meir defending the established calendar and warning, don't you dare change it. And Rav Sadia reports this in two letters that he then writes to his students in Egypt. Ben Meir nonetheless issues an official proclamation. The date is unknown, but it is thought to have been Hoshana Rabbah, still the year 921, secular calendar. It's now the year 4682 on the Jewish calendar, September, October, whatever that was. And he shows that day because that was when Jews traditionally gathered to handle communal matters. Rav Sadia is in Baghdad, and he hears about this. So what was Ben Meir's issue? What was this about? So in order to understand this, you need to know some things about how the calendar works. We're going to do this. Do you guys like math?
Okay.
We're okay with math, hopefully? I don't know. Let's see how this goes. So the halachic hour, I put this on the sheet to try to help. The halachic hour is divided up into 1,080 halakim. Okay? Like when we announced the molad, we talk about a certain number of halakim. So as I wrote on the sheet, 3 1/3 seconds is a chelak. Why 1,080? So there are all sorts of Kabbalistic associations with that, the permutations of the name of Hashem, all sorts of stuff. But there are 1,080. That's one thing to know. Second thing to know, the molad. We announce the molad of whatever month is coming up. The molad is not an actual astronomical time. The molad is supposed to be the time when the moon enters its new phase, which happens at conjunction with the sun, right? Earth, moon, and sun are in a line. You can't see the moon. The moon is occluded. You're not going to be able to see it. That's supposed to be when it enters its new phase. But the reason I say that it's not a real astronomical time is because the way you calculate the molad is there's a starting point when Hashem created sun, moon, and stars, right? Day 4 of creation. We have an average period of the moon. And all you do in order to get the molad is you add that period of the moon to the last molad, which was added to the previous molad, which was added to the previous molad, going all the way back to the initial creation, which you assume was the new moon at the conjunction of Earth, Sun, and Moon. That's the idea. You could argue, well, that would be an odd conjunction. That would be an odd arrangement for Hashem to choose to create them, because that would mean Hashem created them with Earth being unable to actually see the new moon. Right? If it's in conjunction, why would Hashem create it at a time when it's invisible? But that's neither here nor there. That's the assumption.
But to add on, you're saying this is how the fixed calendar is set?
Yeah, correct. No, but this is the way they did it even before the fixed calendar. The conjunction, you can't determine it by observation, by definition.
Because it's blind.
Exactly.
Right, right.
So this was always the way that they set the molad. And the problem with it, in terms of the molad being accurate, is that the moon's period is not fixed. It shifts every month. There's an average period of the moon, obviously. Any set of numbers, you can find an average. But there's a wobble to it. So it's not as though you can really have an accurate... Exactly. It's not like, Earth going around the sun. So we have a set number. For all I know, at enough of a minute level, maybe there's variation there also, but it's insignificant for our purposes. With the moon, it actually is off. We know that's not the precise conjunction. So, but that's what the molad is. The molad is supposed to be the time when the moon enters its new phase in conjunction Earth, Moon, and Sun. Okay. Two rules that you need to know, and then we're ready. Two rules of the fixed calendar. These are rules that are built into the calendar as we use it. Number one, Rosh Hashanah cannot start on a Sunday, right? Lo adu Rosh. Rosh Hashanah can never be Sunday, Monday. It also can't be... It can't be Sunday, it can't be Wednesday, it can't be Friday. That's the idea. Day one of Rosh Hashanah cannot be those days. Why? Because we want to avoid Hoshana Rabbah being on Shabbos because of the issue of being able to bang the Aravos, because that was an area where the heretics disagreed with us. I think someone's locked out. I'm going to let him in. Thank you. They did not accept the banging of the Aravos, which was the kind of the Nevi'im, and so we wanted to make sure we would do it every year, but you wouldn't do it on Shabbos. So therefore they said, let's make sure Hoshana Rabbah isn't going to be Shabbos. And they also had a concern. We didn't want to
abstain for that reason.
Correct. And we also had a concern about Yom Kippur being on Friday or on Sunday. You didn't want either of those. So therefore, Rosh Hashanah can't start on a Sunday, Wednesday, or Friday. That's number one. And number two, it's supposed to take 6 hours from the Molad until the moon is visible. Which means, if the Molad happens after midday, the moon will not be visible until after sunset. And therefore, Rosh Chodesh will have to be postponed until that night. That's what the Gemara says that. Sorry?
For the next
day. So, yeah. Right, so the 6 hours turns to 8, let's say.
What do you mean?
Oh, it's declared the next day.
The next day we'll have
one
to.
1 minute.
Right. So that's the issue. So combining those two rules, okay? If the Molad for the Tishrei moon occurs on Tuesday afternoon, so Rosh Hashanah will not end up being on Tuesday, and it will not end up being on Wednesday, because we don't do Rosh Hashanah on Wednesday. So Rosh Hashanah moves all the way to Thursday.
It would have been Tuesday night for the camp.
It should have been Tuesday itself. The Molad is on Tuesday. So really, Rosh Hashanah should be. Really, the conjunction should be when Rosh Chodesh is. But it can't be, because we don't see it until that night. So witnesses couldn't have come to testify. So the witnesses wouldn't have shown up until Tuesday night. And Wednesday can't be Rosh Hashanah.
We can't fix it in the time that it couldn't have occurred with the witnesses occurring.
Yes.
Hillel set it up so that it's as if the witnesses have come.
Yes.
Every time.
And if the Molad for the Tishrei moon occurs on Thursday afternoon, then Rosh Hashanah will be pushed all the way to Shabbos. Because it can't be Friday. And the key for us, if the Molad occurs on Shabbos afternoon, Rosh Hashanah will be pushed all the way to Monday. So in the year 4681 of our calendar, which is 921 Common Era, it was anticipated that in the year 4684, which is to say September 923, Rosh Hashanah is September of 923. It's
a year and a half.
It's a year, yeah. It's 2 years. It's 2 years. It's really, I mean, it's year from when they're sitting, but it's the second year from. It's not the year 922. It's the year 923. September of 923. The beginning of 4684. Rosh Hashanah is going to have that 2 day postponement because the Molad of Tishrei is 13 or 14 minutes after midday on Shabbos. Ben Meir argues, if you can grab that door. So Ben Meir argues that if the Molad happens within 642 chalakim, about 35 minutes after noon, Rosh Hashanah is not postponed. And therefore, Rosh Hashanah should not be postponed that year. He says, it's not if it's after midday. It's after 12:35 p.m., so to speak.
Right.
You have a window there still. It's not about midday. Where did he invent 642 halakim? So I'm going to give you three of the approaches to this. The first approach comes from Rachamim Sar Shalom. In an article you can find online in the Dot website, I gave you the link on the sheet. And his argument is an astronomical argument. He says the fixing of the original Molad that we use as the basis at each time, the period of the Molad to get to that, was done in the 9th century, not when the calendar was originally set. That was when they actually calculated the original Molad and said, okay, this is when our Molad was. It's based on documents in the Cairo Geniza. So there was a debate as to how we place the original Molad. In Israel, they did it based on Nisan, a Wednesday in Nisan plus 9 hours.
What in
Nisan? A Wednesday, because it has to be a Wednesday, because that's when Hashem created sun, moon, and stars. So it was a Wednesday, the beginning of the month of Nisan, plus 9 hours.
What's the 9 hours?
Right, so for that you have to go through Sar Shalom stuff. The Bavel count said no, it was the following Tishrei that they were working from, and it was a Friday and 14 hours. And again, you have to go through the documents
that's
that he
Bavel?
Has. That's Bavel. So they have a different starting point for the Molad. Both of them are based on trying to create, says Sar Shalom, a round calculation for the Molad, counting back to a point in that first year and finding a way that works and makes the count convenient. But if you work with Tishrei, as they did in Babel, that leaves if you took that Tishrei and then you counted your Molad backwards to get to Nisan, you would find it to be Wednesday, 9 hours, and 642 halakim. Right? So their Molad that they're working with in Bavel, he says, is actually 642 halakim off from the correct Molad. He said it was started out on Wednesday and 9 hours. In other words, 9 a.m. on Wednesday was his argument. And so you start going forward, adding, and you end up not, and when you get to Tishrei 6 months later, you're not at a clean number of 14 hours.
You went back to actually show how when they calculated, they actually looked at Nisan.
Yes.
And they said, we're at Tishrei now, we've got to declare a month. We're now 642 halakim past the 9 hour period.
Yes.
6 hour period or 9 hour?
The
6 hours.
No, the 642 halakim
passed.
It would be Wednesday 9 hours and 642 halakim instead of Wednesday 9 hours even. It's 642 halakim off. So the argument that he has is therefore, you're wrong with your 642 halakim. Your previous molad is always 642 halakim off, and therefore the argument goes in the event that the molad that you're calculating is within that 642 halakim zone, it actually belongs with
the old day.
Correct.
Day.
Now, from the year...
So you have to also declare Rosh Hashanah the night before.
Yeah.
Because the year
correct. Correct. That's all Gemara and Rosh Hashanah, but what happens if midday happens and then and witnesses show up and all of that.
Right, but that was with witnesses. Then,
yeah. But you're calculating it, so you know it's going to be the night before, correct. But we're declaring this day.
But there's no avoda at night, so it doesn't matter.
There's no avoda at all
when
they're doing this.
Well,
you're post-Beis HaMikdash. Correct.
Right. It didn't matter about the night being.
I mean, that's the discussion in the Gemara and Rosh Hashanah about what happened that morning and yeah. So the years passed from the time they set this, which according to Sar Shalom's calculations was the year 839. Was when they did this setting of the Molad. So the years passed after that, and the difference was irrelevant that whole time, and everybody was okay, until they get to this point where it's going to push off Rosh Hashanah. That's his argument about why Ben Meir started this fight at this time.
To the point it was never going to be a two-day postponement.
Yeah, correct. I find that difficult to think that you really weren't going to have a two-day postponement at any point in that 84-year period. But Sar Shalom is an astronomer. He's like he's a calendar guy.
I mean, it's possible. I mean, because you're dealing with
Right. It's not that you weren't going to have a two-day postponement. It's that a two-day postponement because of the Molad being in that window. Right. That's true. So that's one school of thought. Second,
some years it won't matter at all. Right. Some years
it's still
matter.
Have a two-day.
Yeah, just we're running out of time, so I want to just make sure we get through the story. This is not the kind of story where you want to hold it over the next week. So, Ben Meir, for his part, the second approach is Ben Meir wants to reduce the number of rabbinic postponements. He just doesn't like the idea that we keep postponing things, and he says, let's add some period of time, so it isn't at midday that's the cutoff, but midday plus. And it will reduce the number of postponements. That doesn't explain why 642, which just seems like a very random number. Presumably it's not, but that's what it sounds like to my ears. And that's why Rav Sadia comes out so adamantly against it, because that sounds like Karaism. Not that he's a Karaite. Ben Meir is not a Karaite. But when Ben Meir says, I don't like this idea that we're shoving off the day of Rosh Hashanah so much, that sounds like his concern is a Karaite concern of rabbis don't mess with the calendar. That's a second argument. Third explanation for it is that it was Israel versus Bavel. Ben Meir himself, in his writings, some of which we have, predicated his argument on the idea that Israel was primary, and you're supposed to follow the Israeli Beis Din, even if they're wrong, the Gemara says. Atem afilu shogin, atem afilu mutin, atem afilu mizidin. Right? The Torah says, atem, you shall be the ones to calculate it, even if you get it wrong. Even if you get it wrong on purpose, it's still whatever you say. So it's supposed to be the Israeli Beis Din. Now, Rav Sadia, we have his writing on this, replies that Kiddush HaChodesh with witnesses, this is mind-blowing. He says, Kiddush HaChodesh with witnesses, the whole thing about seeing the moon and all that, was a later phenomenon. He says the original method was calculation. Yeah, it blows your mind, huh? He said the original method was calculation, and they added witnesses only in order to counter the Sadducees when they challenged rabbinic authority. So they said, all right, fine, we're going to have witnesses. But the authority in Israel was not because of the witnesses. It was because of calculations. And we know the calculations in Bavel. We don't need you.
He's saying it's very late.
He's saying
instituting witnesses very late.
Yes.
During the
second base of Mikdash.
Right.
Yes.
The first base of Israel, you have witnesses. It's crazy.
That's what he said. He's Rav Sadia. You're not.
I know.
It's wild. I mean, no one else says this. So. So I don't know. I don't know where Rav Sadia gets it, but it's a wild contention, and nobody else is on the same page.
Is this also all part of like what we saw with Yaakov Emden and those after Chatzai speak? Everybody went a whole different direction because they were fighting all of these false messiahs here.
You're going the opposite direction. So I've seen that alleged, but I don't know. But that's the idea. On the other hand, Ben Meir is running counter to the Gemara, because the Gemara talks about Chatzos, right? If the moon is not if the Molad is not until after Chatzos, then you push it off. Like, it's straight Gemara. So that's the that's a third approach. The result is an incredible disruption. News of Ben Meir's proclamation gets to Bavel. The exilarch, the Reish Galus at the time, is David ben Zakkai, and he, along with the Gaonim of both yeshivos, and probably Rav Sadia as well, even though he wasn't a Gaon yet, send an official cease and desist letter to Ben Meir, defending the calendar as it is, warning him against the change that he is contemplating. They send letters to Jewish communities saying, stick with the calendar that we have decreed. And Rav Sadia, as we said, writes to his Talmidim in Egypt, saying that they should oppose what Ben Meir is doing. Ben Meir sends his son to Yerushalayim from the yeshiva to proclaim the change in the calendar. He says the Gaonim are not the authorities, don't listen to these people in Bavel. And he sends letters to his Talmidim, who are in Bavel, arguing that he is right, raging against Rav Sadia. Comes Pesach. You have people who are prepared to use Ben Meir's date. You have others who are standing up for the accepted calendar. Rav Sadia again writes letters on this, imploring everybody to follow the calendar of the Gaonim. Most Israeli communities and some Babylonian communities actually observed that Pesach and that Shavuos with Ben Meir's date. They went with his calendar. And according to our records, twice more the Gaonim dueled with Ben Meir the following summer. And in fact, there were those who observed Rosh Hashanah on a different date, Yom Kippur on a different date. There is a Syrian historian who reports, as well as Karaites who report, that at the beginning of the year 4683, but I thought the whole problem was 4684. Now I'm not sure about the years that I wrote down in my notes. But the following year, whatever that following year was, the quarrel was still in progress. Rosh Hashanah was in fact observed by these two opposing parties on different days. And Rav Sadia says that the Gaonim, having failed in all of their efforts against this Ben Meir, thought about calling the government for assistance, which you never want to do. But they decided not to, and instead they issued a memorial volume, Sefer Zikaron, which we have fragments of, which records all of Ben Meir's misdeeds and what the Gaonim did against him, their reasons for upholding the calendar, and they broadcast this all around the Gola, all around the diaspora, to have a public reading of this book on the 20th of Elul before the approach of the following Rosh Hashanah, warning against any future upheavals. Rav Sadia is the one who composes this, And it is read publicly, and it puts an end to the agitation. And nothing more is heard of Ben Meir in the following years.
Yeah.
There's more to say, but I think what we'll do next time, God willing, is see Rav Sajja as Gaon in Surah and talk more about his writings. I think what we'll look at next is his Sefer HaGalui, perhaps, and his Emunos Videos on Jewish philosophy. That'll be hopefully for next week. Okay?
Thank you very much.